and welcome to the next episode of the podcast on negotiation. And today, our very special guest is Brian Gensen. Brian, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Brian has become a mediator at the age of 19. Can you imagine this? At the age of 19, at that age, I had completely different topics on my mind. And it seems that conflict resolution and negotiation has accompanied you ever since. Now you are a successful established professor in the field of negotiation and conflict management, based in Cape Town at Stellenbosch Business School. You're also active in various NGOs and invest a lot of your time and effort into helping people resolve conflict and restore peace. Brian, is there anything that I forgot?
No, nothing important. And I'm sure if it is, it'll come out along the way.
All right. Thank you for being with us. And today we would like to talk about the connection which is gaining in importance, the connection between sustainability and negotiation, sustainability and socially responsible negotiations. I would like to start at, let's say, the dominating paradigm, the interest-based interest-based approach, right? So for the last 40 years, there's not much that has changed in the field. We've been all teaching, you know, that it's how to get to yes, that it's important to think about our interests. It's important to elicit interests of others. And Brian, why did we overlook sustainability in this for 40 years?
Well, I wanna maybe, while we'll come back to that, remind ourselves that interest-based negotiation, as Mary Parker Follett first conceptualized it in the early 20th century, so 100 years ago, was very much premised on a sustainability frame. She reminded us that the easy way was war. Fighting with each other is so, so easy and yet so destructive. And she reminded us that peace was the result of great toil, great engagement by the parties to uncover and deal with the real issues. So I think we can hold our heads up high and say, even if we didn't have the whole picture, it came from a place of sustainability. Roger Fisher, in reinvigorating Mary Parker Follett's work and bringing it to broader audiences, also talked openly about his experience in World War II and the horrors of war as necessitating a better way to negotiate. So I think I don't want to throw us under the bus completely as people who have been engaged with and on these issues. I think perhaps the challenge comes in when we think about the field of negotiation, right? And this is, to be clear, it's lots of negotiators think about sustainability all of the time, either because they're working on sustainability issues or because they are concerned with how sustainability is expressed or not expressed in other negotiations. So what I'm talking about here is the field of negotiation. Our view has been perhaps a little bit narrow. Our narrative often starts with parties arriving at the table, right? And when we think about how we teach negotiation, right? The pedagogy of interest-based negotiation. You arrive and I arrive and there's something called a negotiation and we start engaging in it. And so a whole host of questions around who's not at the table, what interests and voices are not heard, we have been perhaps lax in listening to that evolving conversation in other fields and bringing it into our domain.
Wow. So yours, basically, if I understand you correctly, it's been out there, but it has not been explicitly, it has not been made explicit, right? So we are basically focusing on those who are present at the table and their vested interest in finding an agreement between each other, or generating and dividing value between each other.
Right. We at least tacitly assume that the interests as articulated by the parties present are sufficient to understand the situation and craft a solution.
But they aren't.
In many cases, they are not. Right.
Right. So let's before we discuss these cases in more depth, let's try to focus on the key word in those sentences that we have just exchanged, on interest. Yes. What is it and what is it not?
So, right. Interests are what matter to us, right? So my interests can be tangible. I might be looking for a higher fence between your house and my house. They may be intangible. I may be seeking respect and recognition. They may be financial. They may be value-based. Right? They may be an interest in seeing a fairer world. So interests in the simplest term are what matter, right? Mm-hmm. And immediately we get brought into questions of agency and of rights, and because we have to ask, well, whose interests? And I would argue that largely the field of negotiation as it's pursued today doesn't spend a lot of time on those questions.
Do that for them. Yes.
Yeah.
What can we do? What can we do to sort of broaden the perspective from the very narrow definition of interest, meaning what's important to the parties at the table, to a more reasonable definition, which means which would probably indicate everything that is important not only to those who are there, but to those who are affected by what's happening at the table, or especially by the agreement that might be found between those who sit at that table. So what can we do? What can we do to broaden this perspective?
Right. So I think there are two things. One, in relationship to the negotiators, those of us who find ourselves at the table, and the other has to do with the kinds of analyses and processes we advocate for. So as to the negotiator, we need to get comfortable talking about issues of ethical orientation, right? Who am I at the table? And who I think, and this is, I'm in advocacy mode. I would doubt that everybody agreed with me on this, but I would say we don't leave our identities as community members and family members and citizens and people who care about the future of the planet at the door simply because on my business card is director of sales. So I think part of the answer to this question is the negotiator as leader. Somebody who accepts all of her identities and finds way of bringing them into the room, because then naturally more interests are already at the table, right? If she leaves every identity other than director of sales out in the hallway, then a lot of thought processes and ideas and considerations don't come in. I think from the negotiation process, I know what we do here in our context is we start the negotiation process with a contextual analysis. What is the context in which this negotiation unfolds? What implications does it have for where the system finds itself today? And therefore, what are the dangers and opportunities for our negotiation with respect to those broader systems dynamics, right? I think perhaps in South Africa, that may be an easier conversation. We're all acutely aware of the old regime up until our new constitution came into effect in 1997, so relatively recently in international terms. We're adolescents from a national standpoint. And so I think there is perhaps an easier to say, okay, we know we want to heal divisions of the past. We know we need to be cautious about not reactivating divisions in society that almost destroyed us. And so I would say, you know, we maybe have an easier time of it, but the task is the same, is to situate, wait a minute, how did we arrive here from a systems context? So that as we craft a path forward, we're doing that in the wisest way possible.
Mm-hmm. So if I understand it correctly, this contextual analysis is a determining factor for broadening our perspective in terms of the definition of interest, and which guides us towards smarter or wiser and more sustainable agreements. Is that
it increases, it creates the opportunity to do so, right? It does not compel people. You might bring that broad perspective to the table, and I might say, I don't care, and legally I don't have to. So it does not necessarily result in a better outcome, but it creates the opportunity for a more just and sustainable outcome because we've surveyed the terrain, we've examined the system of which we're part, and we are more likely to have top of mind issues that we wouldn't have top of mind if I only came in with that narrower sense of what are we doing here.
Mm-hmm. So now let's conduct a short thought experiment. Yes, let's remove that contextual analysis. Let's say two negotiators walk right in. They've done a negotiation course, not as good as yours, but a negotiation course which taught them, hey, focus on your interests and try to figure out the best possible outcome while incorporating the interests of your negotiation partner. Does this perpetuate inequality and environmental damage? And if so, in what, or can it potentially be dangerous or pose risk to the society and to the environment? And if yes, in what way?
So I'm going to use a concrete example.
Perfect.
You may or may not be familiar with and our listeners with the New Alliance for Food Security and Nutrition in Africa. What a wonderful name. An alliance, food security and nutrition, Africa, a place where those are issues. It was an initiative of the G8. So saying, how can we promote food security and nutrition? And the notion was to bring together some smart folks from international NGOs. So the Gates Foundation is prominent in the new alliance. It brought together experts in food production. It brought together heads of African governments and their agricultural ministries, and it brought together companies, large agribusiness companies in particular, with a notion that to raise food production, we would need to create an enabling environment for investment. And the notion was that because governments and NGOs were at the table, that there would be checks and balances in the system. And there are aspects of what came out of that you and I would recognize as the children of interest-based processes. People thought hard about the problems, came up with solutions, and created a system that worked for the negotiators at the table. The trouble was that there were no representatives of smallholder farmers. There were no representatives of experts in food insecurity and the drivers of food insecurity. There were no representatives of environmental organizations. And so a whole set of concerns were not raised, not considered, and not integrated into the solutions. So we have something that is superficially an interest-based negotiation, held out as such, and I would, without having been in the room, the outcomes suggest to me that there was creative thinking and there was consideration of what worked and didn't work, and there was an intention to make it work, not simply to impose solutions. But what do we see? We see a set of policy interventions and investments that have been found to reduce food security in Africa. They increase food production, but they do it in a way that is very good for large producers, large foreign investors, and export agriculture. So I don't know, maybe on the margin it's increasing food security in Germany or Denmark, but it is reducing food security in the countries in which these investments are being made. It is, because so much of it is tied to export agriculture, because that's how a multinational gets its money back out of the country, right? It is by selling into foreign markets. It has subjected already poor and vulnerable populations to the shocks of commodity markets, right? If consumers abroad change their mind on what they want to buy, then the small producer who has been encouraged to leave production for her own family or for local markets is now left with nothing. There are issues around the viability of moving to markets where farmers are forced to buy seeds. And what does that mean for diversity? What does that mean for pressures on land and water? Because those may not be appropriate to local conditions, and so on and so on and so on, right? So very clearly, who was at the table determined what matters, and therefore the solution sets that would be considered, however creatively, however collaboratively, however constructively.
Mm-hmm. That can be very unfortunate, and indeed can lead to outcomes that perpetuate inequality and are simply bad for those who are not there. Yes. But let's imagine, Brian, that are students, yes, who have heard about contextual analysis, who have heard about, you know, getting everybody who is impacted by a potential agreement to get involved in the negotiation, right? So, and they want to incorporate the principles of sustainability in their negotiations and socially responsible negotiations. What obstacles and barriers can they experience while doing so?
Right. So I think the very first one is going to be within their own organizations. And we're going to probably, to move this agenda forward as a field, need to study that, develop better advice, because imagine you work for Tesco, a big retailer in the UK. It's a cutthroat market, a very low margin business. There's not a lot of fat in the system in food retailing. And you arrive in South Africa where you've been sent to buy apples. We're a big hardwood fruit. I'll use examples close to home. I know them a little bit better. And you are negotiating to buy high quality fruit at what Tesco considers a reasonable price, right? Problem is that the amount that Tesco is offering for apples does not add up to a living wage for apple farm workers. There's a little bit more money and a little bit wages as you move up the value chain, so in the packing houses or in some of the other parts of the process. But for the men and women who are in the fields picking apples, the amount of money that Tesco is offering does not add up to a living wage as defined by the ILO. Your mandate from your own company is to engage to reach an unsustainable agreement, right? So I think the very first thing that is limiting this kind of thinking in practice is the internal negotiation. What is our advice to the apple buyer for Tesco? Right. How does he or she open space for that conversation? How do they think about that in the immediate term? Apples need to be bought and sold this season. How do they think about it in the medium term? How do they think about it in the long term?
Right. So internal, clarifying the mandate. Is it pure commercial terms, or do the terms right. need to be socially responsible as well? Yes. So that's a barrier number one. Are there any other barriers? Well, I'm sure there is also an issue of, let's say, factors which are on the side of our negotiation partners. They might not simply be interested in expanding their interest view and in incorporating into their thinking, let's say, interest of others. It might reduce their margin, reduce their revenue, right?
And that's often going to be the case, right? There's a great deal of literature that is well-grounded that says under certain circumstances, social responsibility and profitability go together, right? Mm-hmm. However, if you're working in an environment that does not have high regulatory standards, then in fact, there's huge opportunity to externalize your social and environmental costs, right? Right. So there is good evidence that mining companies choose conflict adjacent areas because they are then guaranteed a lower regulatory burden. At some point, there are trade-offs between profitability and sustainability. And the closer we get to those trade-offs, the harder the task becomes, right? That's why I started with that, right? I would say even before the internal mandate we talked about already is the personal mandate. Who do I choose to be?
Yes.
Right?
Yes, then exactly.
How do I work within my organization to craft a sustainable mandate so that I and my counterparts can take this on? May I make it even harder, or are we depressed?
Please do. let's make it as hard as we can.
Right. So then the third thing I think we have to think about. So we now have presumptively, or in a good case, we have a negotiator, and she's taken on leadership for sustainability. She has found a way to remind her own organization of the importance of sustainability and brought them along. And then she goes into the negotiation. There's another level that we haven't explored yet, which is whose voice, who speaks, who represents interests at the table. We can see in cases where people are denied the responsibility, I'm sorry, the opportunity to be part of the decision-making process. That itself can be conflict-inducing. It will create frictions. It will introduce blind spots, because as much as I would like to think that I'm aware of agriculture issues and would like to reach a sustainable agreement with respect to social and environmental issues, farm workers will want, and justifiably so from my standpoint, will want to speak for themselves.
Yes.
And so now we're facing the problem that something that sounded so easy and so private, I want to sell apples, you want to buy apples, has taken on the structure of a quasi-public process, right? More stakeholders, more voices, more participation. I would say the evidence is pretty strong that, one, when we don't do that, bad things happen, right? When we don't, people will be heard. We can choose how they're heard, or we can influence how they're heard by inviting them to the table and into processes. If we try to leave them outside the door, they will find a way to be heard that is more destructive, even to us and our interests. So on the one hand, we can acknowledge that excluding parties and their interests poses problems, but also we have to acknowledge, and this is where I think also the field is perhaps a little bit on the back foot, is opening the door creates friction costs and transaction costs.
Precisely. That would be my next question, Ryan, right? So we know that the extreme poles of these continua, because we described several, right, are no good.
Yes.
Bad things are going to happen to some people, either at the table or affected by the agreements, settled by them, right? So how to strike the balance? Is there, I know that I'm asking you this question is probably very difficult, right? So if both extreme points are not good, that there must be an equilibrium somewhere in between them, right? But the question is, how do we find it? How do we strike the balance between long and short term, between commercial and sustainable, commercial conditions and sustainability, right? So I know this question is not easy, and probably research has not delivered a precise answer yet, but what is the intuition of our expert, Brian Gensen, on this topic?
Well, I think it's twofold, right? And I think you open the door to the answer by asking about shorter term scenarios and longer term scenarios. And I would say in the short term, we know a great deal about what effective public diplomacy, public mediation looks like.
Yes.
We know how to ask the question, who's not at the table? We know how to design processes, if not on the fly, at least emergent processes where the parties are part of setting up the process by which they will be heard, consider options, make trade-offs, and move forward. So I think part of it is expanding, maybe breaking down some of the barriers between negotiation narrowly construed and the broader family of conflict resolution approaches, and say, yep, if you find yourself in a difficult place without a lot of institutional support, you're going to have to build the structure by which people come together, resolve their differences,
right,
and move forward. That tells us that we need to institutionalize better ways of working together over time, because that's exhausting, expensive, and ultimately unsatisfactory if everybody is trying to do that. Untenable, right?
Right.
Can't all show up to every forum on every issue to have our voices heard. We have to feel comfortable that our needs and interests, at least in a class of people, as somebody who lives in a particular neighborhood, as somebody who is concerned about water quality, as somebody who is interested in fair wages, as somebody who's interested in maintaining space for new technologies and new productive approaches to be brought into the economy, right? Not freezing us into an old way of being and doing. We have to build systems by which and institutionalize ways of working that give people confidence that they don't have to show up all of the time, right? And that starts to look to again blur or at least break down some of the boundaries between negotiation and governance, right?
Right. So are you thinking about legal norms when you say institutionalizing the process, like, for example, the supply chain or sustainable supply chain directives that are right now going into force within the EU and other initiatives? Are you thinking about legal norms that somehow
it can include legal norms, mm-hmm, right? It doesn't need to. If every buyer in Europe was committed on moral or religious grounds to paying prices that enabled a living wage, the legal norm might not matter. That might be a stronger institutionalization than the legal one. We have lots of legal norms, and then the enforceability becomes such a challenge, right? So I'm a fan. I think law, we forget, can be extremely efficient. It's so much easier once we agree to entrench that. It also levels up the playing field.
Right.
Then I don't have to worry about my competitor undercutting me, right?
Exactly.
We can all raise the floor together. So for certain functions, law is extremely efficient, and I would hate to take it out of our arsenal. But I don't think we can think about it that narrowly, because we have to accept that these issues of sustainability, whether environmental or social, often come up with contexts exactly because the legal system isn't as strong as it needs to be. and you know, professional ethics matter, right? I think we could ask this question, and maybe the answer is they go hand in hand. But I like to think we probably do a better job keeping mediation on track through how we train mediators, how we talk about and engage around professional ethics of mediation, than simply a law sitting out somewhere. So I think we have to look at the full range of approaches to institutional. All institutionalization is reaching agreement, right, on what's the right way to do things.
Right, which touches upon our role as educators, right, Brian? Because if it's not law, then it has to be us.
Right.
I think we are all born with a natural sense of community, yes, what's good and what's bad, and it's perpetuated through our socialization, right, throughout our education mm-hmm. process. And in business, it's us who help our students understand what kind of a person they would like to become when they are the ones who end up making those allocation decisions, right? Knowing that depending on a certain allocation call, there might be environmental costs connected with it, right? And how do we incorporate that into the overall sustainable accounting system? Let me put it like this,
right.
Spontaneously, right? Because you said, well, if people are not heard, they will, in a particular place, they will make sure that they are heard elsewhere or in another way, right? Which will generate transactional costs and others, right? So, Brian, how do you teach your students to be more sustainable and socially aware negotiators?
Right, so first of all, I think it's in the framing of the task itself. Part of this is just the name, but we call our course negotiation leadership. We start on the premise that how you lead will make a difference to the outcome, and therefore where you lead and what the choices you make about what matters and doesn't matter from the get-go. Right. So we frame it as a leadership task of taking the negotiation in a way that matters to you, to the things you believe in, to your children, to your community. Right. Second of all, we do spend energy reminding ourselves of the normative frameworks for which we are responsible. And again, in the African context, those are not necessarily or predominantly national legal frameworks, which can be very weak both in their substance and in their enforcement. So we remind people that ILO standards are binding universally, right? That in fact there is a right to a living wage, and therefore I am responsible for enforcing that. Right? The fact that I can get away with not paying it doesn't make it right and doesn't make it legal. Right?
That's correct.
And so we spend time on the normative frameworks, and we ask people to access inside themselves, again, because I feel like that is the strongest rooting. It's not, oh, you're going to get punished. It's that question of who do you want to be? And when people access their religious upbringings and their community upbringings and their family upbringings, they go, wow, this isn't so hard, is it? In terms of where I want to lead, right? This question of multiplicity of identity that we ask people to explore. And then I think the biggest substantive differences. One is in this contextual analysis. We step back from the table and say, yes, I see this as a question of buying or selling apples, but where does, oh, that's also how a community funds its schools. It's also how people feed their families and potentially extended families in our context, right? So we try to open that up. And then and you've already alluded to this, we do treat a communitarian orientation, right? Trying to make it work as the natural state, right? We are not, in our teaching, Hobbesian, where we say life is nasty and brutal and short, and so therefore as negotiators, our job is to overcome that. We rather flip it on its head and say, you know what? In most all cases, we do try to get along. In my daily life, it is full of cooperative and collaborative behavior. If we treat the failure to address sustainability as a set of barriers, we can maybe better overcome them. So we say base case is you and I would get together with concerned stakeholders and reach a sustainable agreement. Let's take that as the base case rather than the exception. Now we can ask this powerful question, what's in our way, right? What is keeping us from doing what we at our dinner table would naturally agree we would like to see happen? Why can I not be the person I want to be, the company I want to be, the actor I want to be in my negotiation? Because that's, in my experience, students find that quite liberating. They're like, oh, okay, there's a barrier. We got to either go through it, around it, over it, remove it, right? But it becomes the task. How do I get from the place I am to the place that feels right? And in my experience, treating it that way, students find more energy and courage to do what we agreed at the beginning is a very, very difficult task.
Love it, Brian. We'll come back to negotiation performance and moral wisdom, and let's say the reasonability of including moral wisdom in while talking or speaking about negotiation performance. But we do have a question from one of our listeners and viewers, from Ezra. Let me read it out loud for those who cannot watch us live. Businesses like banks are regulated. In the change theory towards a better society, in brackets, which percentage, in your opinion, is compliance and which percentage is organizational motivation and ambition? So legal system versus personal values. What do you think, Brian?
Right. So here's where subject matter expertise does matter, right? You need the right people at the table. It's going to be parts of the business are going to be extremely attentive to, sensitive to, and responsive to regulatory requirements. So a bank reserve requirements, right? How much does the a bank set aside for bad loans and other contingencies? I would say that's probably in the 99% regulatory space.
Yeah. If not 100.
If not 100, the system is designed to enforce a particular result. Right. And on the one hand, the regulator will punish you if it's too low compared to what was set. And if you simply hoard extra money, the markets will punish you because they say you don't need to be holding that money. Why aren't you putting it to work? So parts of the business. Are we going to take on the hard task of making home ownership more accessible to poor South Africans. So we're going to need to go outside of our comfort zone because it's not merely a banking problem. There are other parts of the puzzle that have to come together. Are we going to commit to engaging with stakeholders? It's good for our business, and it's really hard, and it may have in the end a lower margin than some other line of business we could choose to go into with that time and energy and money. That's close to 100% organizational motivation, right, and ambition. And lots of things will sit between those on the spectrum.
Yeah. So the answer is it depends, Ezra, as very often.
But it depends on the context, right? We're saying...
Yes.
And then we need to remember too that very often the people we are teaching and the people who are asking the questions tonight, they're the grown-ups in the room. They are the people who are privileged often to think about maybe we need to change the context.
Right. I love that.
Maybe we can't solve the Apple problem this season. But we can take responsibility to make it a little better next year and a lot better 5 years from now.
And we are taking this responsibility together, Brian, right? We've proposed a special issue for the negotiation journal, which will be devoted to sustainability and negotiation. To this intersection. So if among our viewers or watchers are those who would like to contribute to this special issue, please make sure you reach out to us. And we have vested interest in driving this topic. It's a very impactful research area. It's an area, research area, which has the potential to expand our current understanding of negotiation processes and how it's taught around the world. So guys, please reach out to us. There are also two other editors who are not with us. And they are also, I think we'll try to schedule other episodes of our podcast with them so that you guys can get to know them a little bit better and their view on this subject matter. But yes, please bear in mind, sustainability and negotiation is a topic that we want to focus on, that we want to ignite interest for. And before I ask my last question, there is one from the audience.
Okay.
Can you share any examples of negotiations that achieve sustainable outcomes and what lessons can be learned from these experiences?
Yeah, There are luckily lots of them to draw from. And part of the challenge, and maybe Remy to riff on your reference to the special issue in answering the question, what we'd like to see more and more brought to light is these good examples. I mean, one of my favorite ones, because it was so unlikely, the power company in Colombia at the time owned by the government managed to bring electricity to a valley that was 100% controlled by the FARC, by the people they were engaged in a war with, through careful attentiveness to parties and interests and possibilities, right? We have these cooperative, collaborative examples across conflict lines, the Isahina case that I'm referring to in Colombia that's been written up is one of the more mind-blowing ones because of all of the factors it had to manage, human rights and social development and ceasefires and tacit negotiations between parties who couldn't even sit at the same table. There are other more straightforward ones, right? I always invite our students to look for the counter narratives, right? We know that Georgia and Abkhazia in Europe, for example, have this what's called a frozen conflict, right? Since the independence declared by Abkhazia and the protection of that by Russia against Georgian interests. Very few people know that Abkhazia and Georgia successfully manage a hydroelectric dam together.
Yes.
People know that it was either today or yesterday, the UN once again, the General Assembly called on the US to stop its sanctions against Cuba. It appears to be an annual event at the General Assembly. And that supports the narrative of broken relations between the US and Cuba. But people are less aware of the American interest section of the US government in Havana under the Swiss flag, but staffed by Americans who get up every morning and work with their Cuban counterparts on issues of often of regional concern, everything from whale migration to the safety of refugees on the ocean. This cooperation is happening. And the lessons, I think, are, one, let's keep our sense of humor and keep our hope, right? Let's let these problems are solved. Two, the leadership component cannot be underestimated. It starts with people who decide they want to live in a different kind of world and therefore want to conduct different kinds of negotiations to co-create that world. I think that would be the big ones for me.
Ryan, it would be probably a perfect moment to end our episode right now, but I still have a question, a very, very last question, and that's about greatness. Yeah, we're currently working on a project which tries to define what greatness means in negotiation. Mm. I'm always on the lookout for inspiration from my guests. So Brian, any historical or contemporary negotiators who you would considered great because maybe of how they approach sustainability and social responsibility in their negotiations? Question mark.
Yeah, I mean, I think I am partly because of who has been held out as great negotiators in the past, and I am a little dubious about the project of trying to identify great negotiators. I would prefer that we concentrate on great negotiations, because I believe very much that interest-based negotiation is a collaborative endeavor. It is about facing reality together, imagining possibilities together, creating new possibilities together. And by definition, as you've heard me talk about, those great negotiations were the result of the personal and organizational leadership of many, many more parties. And I think if we try to point at the individual, we're kind of missing the point.
So you're saying that the best negotiators are the ones who are able to negotiate collectively and collaboratively?
Well, the person who enabled the negotiation, we probably don't even know who all of those people are.
So kudos and salute to all those unnamed great negotiators out there who make great things happen. Yes, who want to live in a world that is not only governed by profit maximization, who want to live in a world that is inclusive. Yes, who are ready to adopt a long-term perspective in their optimization thinking. So, Brian, thank you so much for your words of wisdom. I'm so pumped up. Yes, I've enjoyed it so much. Here we go, from Francesco. Well said.
Francesco, thank you.
Well said. I think we all agree. We've learned a lot from you. Thank you so much for joining us. And guys out there, please remember, special issue on sustainability and negotiation in Negotiation Journal. If you have good ideas for papers, please reach out to us. We're planning a few paper development workshops next year, starting with the first one in April, end of April in Cape Town. Brian will be there, I will be there, and a couple of other super smart people will be there as well. And to, collectively, we look forward to meeting you there as well. Brian, thank you so much. And until the next time on the podcast on negotiation.
Thank you.